Live in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Needless to say, the beast was stunned. A whip crack went his rumpet tail, and the beast was done. He asked us, "Be you angels?" And we said, "Nay, we are but men."
And here we are again, folks. It is Sunday night, and it's time for the Intrepid Radio program right here with me, Scotty Roberts, and my cohort, Dr. John Ward, over there in Sweden. Good evening, John.
Good evening. Or I should say, actually, good morning. I don't know why I always say fall for that good evening malarkey. It's actually good morning, and it's really Monday morning, not Sunday evening.
But well, you are ahead of us over there, so it's 7 hours ahead. So what are you? You have 4 a.m. over there in Sweden.
So nice of you to confirm that we are ahead of you.
At least in time zone. And if you're listening in London, it is now 3 a.m. If you're listening on the East Coast of the United States, it is 10 p.m. And if you're listening on the West Coast, it's 7 p.m. And if you're listening out there in Hawaii, I think it's 5 p.m. So there you go. We've done the around the world. In China, I don't even know if they let us broadcast in China, but if we do, it's probably like I don't know, 9 in the morning or something like that. So there you go, on Monday.
So how are you doing this fine, beautiful morning?
I am doing just fine, and I just got a nice, lovely message from Rocky Stucci that I can't read on air. A greeting to you tonight, John. So if you didn't see that,
I would like to put a big hello out to the guys in the warehouse at the Rocky Stucci place of employment. Beware, Rocky is carrying a certain ailment, shall we say, but I'm sure the ointment is working very well for him. But so let us continue with the show.
It hasn't hit his visible skin, I think, from what I hear. So
not that I'm aware of. No, not that I'm aware of. But you know, one does get these nasty little things when goes into back alleys, I suppose.
Very nice, very nice. I was watching a movie last night. And it reminded me so much of you. I've got to share this. And if folks, if you haven't seen this movie, it's a comedy, but it's based on those. Think of those old movies from the 60s and this, the spy movies where they traveled around the world and there was always some object they were trying to get. And there's all these different people or different groups all trying to do the same thing and get at the same thing. They're all literally and figuratively stabbing each other in the back to get there first. Well, this is what the movie was, and it's a movie with Johnny Depp, and believe it or not, and this is pretty sad for him, I don't think he's hurting anywhere, but this A-list actor, his last 5 movies have flopped at the box office, and this is only the latest. This is number 5. It was the movie Mordecai, and he plays Lord Charlie Mordecai. And he's got a voice like that, and he talks like that, he speaks like that. And he uses all these words like, "Oh, sir, you are, how could you not wear a cravat? Only a mountebank doesn't wear a cravat." You know, and so things like that. And guess who that character made me think of? He's an aristocrat. He's British. He wears a cravat and a nice little pocket silk, and he carries his cane around and all of this. And he has all this high and hoity-toy of the British aristocracy about him. But it's a comedy. And if you want to see a movie and kind of see John Ward brought to life a bit, even though it doesn't really look like him, you know, and it's nothing like that, and it's not perfect, you know, and this guy's a little weaselly, can't really defend himself out of a wet paper bag and things like, well, I don't know. Maybe that is John Ward. No, John.
You could be so horrible, so hurtful, so hurtful.
Well, John has a great past that one of these days we'll pry into, and we'll let you all know how he can kill a man with his thoughts 3 times over. So it's all his training. It's in the training, brother, he tells me. Anyway, I saw that movie. You want to watch a fun movie. I did not find it to be at all worthy of panning because it had Johnny Depp playing the main character, Charlie Mordecai, and it had Gwyneth Paltrow plays his wife. Olivia Munn plays another woman in the film that he gets involved with through all these escapades. Ewan McGregor plays the head of the of MI5, I think it is. And so it's a fantastic, fantastic, fun film to sit and watch. And you'll think of John Ward in the process.
Wonderful. Yes. Wonderful. So what is happening in America? It's gone very quiet.
It has gone a little quiet. What's happening in America mostly is right now it's all the build-up to political elections. And everybody's there's now, here's news, there's now 10, count them, 10 Republican candidates for president. And some of them were people that I've looked at over the years and said, hey, that guy might make a cool president someday if he ever runs. And then there are some of those that were going to run and some of those who fell into a bit of disgrace over. And this is something that bothers me, by the way. The disgrace, say, take Chris Christie. He's the governor of New Jersey. Now, he would have made a great candidate for the Republicans until there was this big scandal about closing down the Washington Bridge or something like that, and that it was being done behind the scenes to get back at somebody else and the Democrats and so on. And it became a big thing. And, of course, Chris Christie says there's absolutely no truth to that. But, John, and all of you listening, as you notice, when you watch politics, sometimes it is the charge that one side makes, knowing that there might not be anything to the charge, but knowing that the other side is going to have to defend it. And so it takes them off point and puts them on defending. It would be like the whole racist caterwaul that went on for so long in politics, all during the current president. Because he is a black man, and he's a black man in the office, there was the tag that was used that if you disagreed with his policy, oh, well, you're racist because you're just against a black man in the office. Now, that is a perfect example of symbolism versus substance. And there is no substance to the argument. But what it does is it leaves the other side in any one of those arguments having to either ignore it, in which it stands out there and it festers because of the way politics and media works, or they have to take time to get off point to defend themselves from the spurious charge. And now I think that's kind of what happened with Chris Christie. But you also look at him and he's kind of just fallen down a bit. And he no longer strikes me as being somebody who has presidential qualities anymore. Although he says some good stuff. Rick Santorum, on the other hand, is a guy that impresses me. Now, even though, and John, you know this, and most of you listening know this, I'm not a Republican. I'm conservative. I'm a libertarian to a certain degree. And I'm a constitutionalist, but I listened to Rick Santorum, and he impressed me more as being much more presidential this time than when he put his name in the hat last time during the last election. And so, and he even admitted I wasn't ready to do it back then, and I fumbled up, and he says, I think I've come back a lot stronger. And so there are people out there that are good people, and there are people that, you know, you've still got Hillary Clinton. And now one other Democrat, I think, has put his name into the race.
Hasn't she pulled out of the race yet after all her email scandals and so forth?
I think the Clintons think they are above that kind of thing. There's something about that that says, my wife has a friend of hers she was talking to just the other day who said, oh, I heard all that stuff about Clinton. I'm still voting for Hillary this year, for president. And I want to ask that person, why are you voting? And folks listening, if you're in the chat room, go ahead and type this in the chat room. You can give us a call if you want. By the way, well, I don't know if you can give us a call tonight because we're on a little different production outfit tonight. So, equipment, I think you can call us at, I'm going to give out a number here. You can try this number if you want to call the show tonight. 952-657-7965. That's 952-657-7965. You can try that, and if you get through to us, I'll bring you on. But if you've got,
and if you get through to the Chinese takeaway, can you get me some wontons, please?
There it is. Yes, with I prefer the egg foo young, please.
I'm sorry. Go on.
Please continue. No, that's all right. If you've got an opinion about this stuff, you can. And we're going to be talking about the topic of preppers a little later on in the show. And there might be some people, I know there's a lot of people on my Facebook that piped up on that when I said, anybody out there preppers? And I'm looking for some preppers. And so if you want to talk about that or add your 2 cents worth, then you can certainly call that number. We'll give it out again after the bottom of the hour break. So if you've got an opinion about this, this whole thing about Hillary right now or any candidate, let's leave it in that category, but specifically talk about Hillary, is somebody who, in my estimation, has disqualified herself, but has not pulled out, and her party is not disqualifying her.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Why is the party not just basically turning around to her and saying, we're not going to back you, and so she has to bow out?
Right. And they're not going to do that, though. Because it's not about getting a person into office who has character. It's about getting a person into office that gives your party the power.
And I mean, there's a serious side to this. Why is the party still backing her? Why has the party not gone out and condemned her actions? I mean, if she's still going to go for election, she could become the next president. And she's running on a ticket that is basically null and void. She's proved herself untrustworthy.
Yes.
In the public eye. So how can you have legitimacy and how can you have trust in a party, a political party, when it is backing a particular candidate who has from the outset proved himself to be untrustworthy in respect of this email fiasco?
And that's the point. And it's not just the email fiasco. It's also with the Clinton Foundation and their finances and so on. It's
the public are not that dumbed down, surely.
You would think not. But I think as we saw with Obama winning a second term, and again, now this is from folks, as you know, I'm a little more conservative than most. I call myself a small C conservative with a libertarian bent and a constitutional scholar, making me somewhat of a Jeffersonian liberal. So that's where I stand when it comes to politics. I tend to support, if it comes down to a GOP versus a Democrat, I usually would tend to support the GOP because I find that they align with me more philosophically than, say, a progressive would. So that's where I come down. So you have to know when I give my opinions, that's what you're hearing from me. And if you want to express your opinions, you're certainly welcome to do that here on this program. When I look at what's going on with Hillary, I say this is somebody like with the re-election of Obama in the second term in 2012, is that, and I've stated this before, we talk about this stuff more on the Situation Room than on Intrepid Radio, but I heard one radio wag put it this way. He said, the country can survive 4 more years of Obama. He said, what the country cannot survive is 4 more years of an electorate or citizens that would put him back in power. And and that makes a hell of a lot of sense. And I think the same thing with Hillary. It would really make me think twice about the electorate and about the way people think if they were to put Hillary in office. Now, I'm not saying that just because she's a Democrat. I'm saying that because of the kind of person she is. Put up a better Democratic candidate, you guys. Come on, you liberal Democratic progressives out there. Don't you have somebody better? You think it's time that a woman be president? That's about her whole platform.
If Hillary was to win, how do you think she would have tackled the G7 summit this weekend? Do you think she would have backed the rest of the European boys and gone gung-ho against Russia?
I really don't know. I would tend to think that Hillary might stand against the Russian intrusion into the Ukraine, that she would stand against what they are obviously attempting to do. I would hope to God she would be against that.
I see her as a homegrown girl. I would see her kind of withdrawing the American presence on the geopolitical stage and concentrating more on homegrown efforts and problems within the states itself, and trying to unify the dysfunctional states as it stands today. And instead of actually bolstering things within Europe and within the Middle East and within Asia and so forth, but garnering, allowing her political pundits to actually garner those relationships while she concentrates more on the home turf. But that's just me.
I tend to think so. But now here's the problem, too. This is one of the things that would plague Hillary, is that with the Clinton Foundation, they garnered so much foreign support for that, that it starts to, and I can't speak to this issue 100% because I still have not researched it out in full, because it involves high finance and all of that stuff and working with other nations. But the bottom line for me with that situation is that they were allowing foreign countries to, in a sense, influence, the potential for influence from them was there while Hillary was the Secretary of State. And that foundation has become a really big fly in the ointment for her right now. Her credibility, once again, is undermined, even though it wasn't necessarily illegal. It is.
Let me see. I don't see that as a problem to credibility. A husband is an expert. No, a husband. Let's put this into reality. Let's really think about this seriously for 2 seconds. A husband is the ex-president of the United States of America. He travels the world doing his bit. And between the Clintons, they manufacture a foundation which allows to take in income from such travels. Now, of course, if the husband is no longer in office, but his wife is, the husband is going to be influential against his wife. The same can be reversed. If the husband was still in office and the wife wasn't, the wife would be influential against the husband. It's a team. You can't say that neither one would talk to the other and influence them in affairs of state. That goes without saying. And if someone was to put a huge chunk of money into the foundation to have a question asked, I think that's going to happen. You can't stop that. We had the same problem in England. It was the Cash for Questions affair, where many of the big corporate boys who sponsored the Conservative government were handing money, and the Labour government, were handing money backwards and forwards to have questions raised within Parliament, within the House of Lords, that pertain to legislation, bills of rights, and so forth, and to have certain laws changed with regards to the various laws of the land. But that's business. That's how the oiled wheels of commerce work. Without that, you're stripping it down to the bare bones. And yes, it becomes a much better political system. But you're not going to. It's not corruption. It's not, you know, it's not a heinous act. It's just one person using their influence over another from a monetary point of view. And I can't really see the big problem there myself.
Well, getting back to the email scandal, somebody over in the chat room said that this is a Fox News thing. And I will bristle at that immediately and say Fox News always gets the doo-doo thrown at it because it takes a different point of view politically. It has a different philosophical point of view. And it's one that says, why aren't the other media that are generally in lockstep with the left, why are they not addressing these issues when it's news? And Fox News does, so therefore Fox News is the standalone. But the Washington Post, I know, has a headline here, "What a mess. Hillary's home server is secure as official ones at the State Department." And she was saying that she didn't have any sensitive issues on that server and in her emails. But in the first two that came off the released list of the first 300, just in the last 2 weeks, they found two security breach issues that were potential security breach issues because of who they were addressed to and who they were, and so on. I'm doing this one off the top of my head. I don't have that information in front of me. But I'm reacting to the Fox News thing. Fox News is as much a purveyor of news and a generator of revenue through purveying news and opinions as any of the other big ones out there. If you want to talk comparison to that, now he's no longer on the air, but at MSNBC, you had Keith Olbermann. The problem is not with Fox News, tell you the truth.
I have no problem with Fox News, actually. I quite like their channel. I quite like the way their journalistic talents, shall we say. They have a way of putting news forward that makes more sense. Yes, they're a little bit biased, and sometimes their news articles can be a little bit off the beaten track, shall we say. All in all, I think it's actually quite a good channel.
Yeah.
But that's me.
Well,
that's me.
You know, and here's the big thing. There's the talk in the chat room is going on about how what she did was not illegal. The problem is there might not be something that is illegal per se because the law was changed while she was in the midst of it all. But the law was changed for a reason.
Scott, this is what I was saying. You know, what she's done isn't illegal. And what she's done can be construed as a huge diplomatic faux pas. But as long as it's kept in the open, as long as nothing's swept under the carpet, she should be able to ride this storm. But
well,
it was the lack of transparency at the beginning which has left a taste in the mouth. And that, for me, is something that should be explored more fully. Why wasn't it transparent in the very beginning? Why was she using external servers? These raise concerns over who she's able to contact outside of the Office of Affairs. And where is the record of that? How is the Secret Service able to maintain its job if you've got the Secretary of State using a different email server to that of what should be used?
Well, right. And even, you know, you've got sites like The Hill and sites like Slate that are all saying what Hillary did with the email was definitely wrong, but was it illegal? That's the question. Can something be wrong on a philosophical level, but not necessarily be illegal by the law? And here's the big question that's been wrapped around this is the credibility and the character and the integrity of the person who's seeking office. Are they willing to be, let's just put a vernacularism on it, are they willing to be slimy to get by doing what they're doing?
And, well, she's a liberal.
Well, there it is. She is a progressive liberal. So, sorry, all my progressive liberal friends and progressive liberal listeners out there. You love to hate us when we talk about this stuff.
I'm not sorry. To all the liberals listening, you know where I stand. You have my commiserations.
Yes.
One day you may change. You may see the light. Go into the light.
Go into the light. Oh, you know, a little interesting political fact came up. And, of course, even Fox News said these polls don't matter at this point. And polls are a very hard thing to gauge. But, yes, and even Fox News, when it's in favor of a Republican, says doesn't really matter all that much, but it's some indicator of the way the country's thinking. And that is that Obama's approval rating now is lower than George W. Bush's was at his lowest point.
So I think it's because he knows he's on the wane. So, I mean, it's neither here nor there. He's set up for life. Obama's going to leave office, and the guy's going to be doing exactly what the Clintons have done. And Tony Blair, for that instance. It wouldn't surprise me if you see Obama taking over some kind of ministerial office in the Middle East on the peace plan. I would see him trying to broker something between Palestine and Israel after his term of office is run out.
Well, I don't know.
That's right. I
don't know if Netanyahu would have him.
There is that. Oh, by the way, did you see that Egypt have taken Hamas off of the terrorist list?
I did see something about that.
Now, I found that, and I actually put a post up on this, and I actually put a little one-liner, but again, you know, I have a wonderful following out there on the social networks, but sometimes you think, wakey-wakey, guys, wakey-wakey, you just need to give them a prod now and again. And no one meant, no one even went anywhere near it, but I put there that it's a very clever political move by Cairo to remove Hamas, because what happened was the lower courts in Cairo had placed Hamas on the terrorist list, and the high courts turned around, or some of the pundits within Cairo has turned around and said, well, it's not within their brief to have placed it there on the terrorist list. It should have gone to the higher courts. It's not the job of the lower courts to do this. So they've removed it off the list for temporarily. And I'm sure there's going to be another judicial review, and they'll probably be put back on again. But temporarily, it's been taken off, which I think is a very, very clever political move on Sisi's part and his government's part to help and try and stabilize the area, especially between in Israel, but more importantly, with what's happening at this present moment between Hamas and Syria and how things are panning out there. Again, we're drawn into the ISIS debacle and what's happening in that and so forth. But again, I think it's a very wise political move by Cairo. And by the way, well done to the opposition party in Turkey who have just won the elections in Turkey. Well done.
Oh, get rid of that's good.
I jumped up for joy when I saw the results coming through last night. And hopefully we'll see Turkey move away from this dictatorial presidency that looked as if it was going to be on the cards as of yesterday afternoon.
Now, generally in those dictatorial countries, you don't see people that are allowed to express themselves democratically. Do you think this is an example of Turkey? And by the way, folks, Turkey bordering Syria up there, and ISIS trying to make incursions into Turkey, and the Turkish army is pretty formidable. Mind you, they are still without. Let's not get into that. Let me just say this: that for Turkey to have an election that allows the opposition party into government, do you think that is any indicator of them expressing democracy, or is that
Turkey,
something else?
I mean, it's funny you should word it in such a way, Scott, because I mean, is that the perception? And I'm going to ask you plainly, is that your perception of Turkey as an American?
Is my perception that they are not democratic?
Yeah.
You know, I think, let me put it this way. I know better, but I will say that the people that I know and the people that I talk to and people in general, when they think of, and sorry to my Muslim friends out there, when they think Muslim-led countries or countries that are predominantly Muslim, they start to lump it all in with extremism. They lump it all in with they want death to infidels. They're thinking even to one extreme or the other. If you're not ISIS, you might be a milder form of that. But this is the perception, I think, that reigns out there, not necessarily being the truth of the matter, the fact of the matter, but this is the perception of things out there, that an Islamic-run country, too, is going to end up being part of this ISIS caliphate.
Well, this is Turkey. I mean, Turkey, without being blasted for this, you can label Turkey in the same basket as you can put Greece in or Spain. Turkey has its paperwork in and on the desk ready for joining. It's considered part of Europe. I mean, it wants to join NATO and the rest of the gang. Turkey itself is a very, very progressive country, even though the predominant government up until yesterday was basically the Muslim Brotherhood, to want of a better extent. The president, which is this new term which they're trying to put forward, was going to take more power. And basically he was looking to rewrite the constitution as of yesterday, believing that his party was going to win again. thankfully, his party hasn't won, and he's left with a very minority government. So he's going to have to form a coalition. And so his presidency is now, and the rewriting of the constitution, of course, has been squashed. And hopefully we will see an end to this kind of semi-dictatorial reign that he's had over the past 13 years. It really does show that there is a movement within the Middle East. And I say that when I loosely to not to put Turkey with the Middle East, but Turkey is kind of on the periphery. And Turkey is a very, one could use a metaphor here. One could say that Turkey is like a temperature gauge for the Middle East, because it's not in the Middle East, but it is in the Middle East, but it's not in the Middle East. It's a temperature gauge for the Islamic, Muslim, Christian, Kurdish, the minority tribes, and how they view their status within the overall scheme of things. And what's happened is that the Kurds have even won 10% of the vote. They've just started. They literally put their hat into the ring, and they've taken a 10% stand in the elections that came through last night. So really, it's very, very exciting to see that secular Muslims have been able to, and Christians have been able to really push forward democracy in Turkey and steer away from what was happening or what seems to have been happening within the Middle East. And so I'm very pleased to see that the elections have worked. It proves that democracy in that vein, when you look at elections, has worked. It has allowed the people to have their voice, and the voice is spoken, and the dictator has fallen. And so onwards and upwards, I say, for Turkey.
Well, there you go. And John, you're sounding very BBC-ish tonight, I just want to say. I'm not saying you're not exciting, and that you don't have verve and vigor, but you're sounding rather. And the Turkish border was closed today after the elections, and you've got a little bit of that sound to you. So we're going to go out to break, and I want you to get some more caffeine in your system, you know, and get some like CoffeeZilla going, so you can come back and you can be right on top of your game, and you can talk like this. You can talk about all the fantastic things that are happening around the world, plus the preppers that we're going to be talking about when we come back. So, John, stand by. Folks, you all sit tight. This is Scotty Roberts, Dr. John Ward, here on the Intrepid Radio program, right here on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. We'll be right back. Sit tight.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be Bridging the Gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields, from ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Bear & Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Are you ready for some rollicking adventure? In Scotty Roberts' book, The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare, join Irish Rabbit, Tam O'Hare, and his young squirrel squire, Horatio McNutt, as they journey through Scotland of the mid-1500s seeking a small child who's been stolen by the fairy folk. Crafty raccoon pirates, conniving noble wolves, conflicted royal foxes, and self-serving religious badgers all stand in the way as their quest brings them headlong into high seas action and supernatural intrigue. The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare is in bookstores everywhere and at barnesandnoble.com. This hardcover, lushly illustrated chapter book is the first book in the Tam O'Hare series, so swash your buckle and prepare yourself for a historically rollicking, swaggeringly supernatural adventure. Visit tamohare.com to learn more. You'll never trust a raccoon with a sword again.
All right, folks, we are back right now with the Intrepid Radio program. I had just a little lapse there. I forgot who I was, where I was, and why I was here. That's what that pause was.
I call that old age, sir.
Oh, it's something. But, yeah, folks, let's start that all over. We're back. We're back from break. This is the Intrepid Radio program, and I've got Dr. John Ward over there in Sweden, and he's joining me live tonight, where it is now, about 4:38 in the morning, so that's kind of nice. Sun come up yet?
The sun's been up since 4 o'clock. Well, since I got up at 3 o'clock this morning.
Oh, that's kinda right. Weird. You're closer to the Arctic Circle up there, so.
It's very weird here. Very weird.
And now is it summer that gives you the really short nights? Or is it winter?
No,
winter's the long nights.
The winter's long nights. We got a really long. The sun doesn't. It's not. It's still light here, basically at midnight. It's kind of ridiculous. You go to bed and it's still daylight. It kind of freaks me out because in Egypt, it's dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Bang, dead.
Right.
Dark,
well, you're dark, equatorial, dark. Close. Damn, yeah. Close to equatorial over there.
Over the past 15 years, I've got used to those dark evenings, even during the summer months. But here, no, light all the way right up until midnight. So it's kind of weird. I just wanted to bring up a thing. There's a news article that's coming out for the BBC.
Yeah.
And this really is pointed towards Rocky Stucci.
Ah.
But I know that we discussed this once. I know we discussed it both here on the Intrepid Radio and on the old Situation Room with Sir Stucci. And that was eating placentas.
Oh, my. And that Sarah Soderlund was part of that conversation as well. Sarah Soderlund, who does Mysteries of the Mind at 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, right after the Situation Room on Thursdays.
Well, the Northwestern University has found that there is no proven benefits and no research on potential risks on eating one's placenta.
Oh, that's a conspiracy.
It has absolutely zero value. It doesn't help with the after effects of pregnancy. It doesn't help with boosting energy. It doesn't protect the woman against depression or replace certain minerals that she may have lost during her pregnancy. It is what it is, a sack of blood. So, moving on.
And, you know, let me do comment on that, is that, as I said back then, I saw no efficacy in taking my child's / wife's placenta and mixing blueberries and pineapple and all kinds of junk into it and blending it up and pouring it down and drinking it. That just never seemed to be, that seemed to be an aberration of things that ought to be. Now there's going to be people out there who swear by it, as did Sarah Soderlund. But it's not something that I find, first of all, not appetizing at all. There's something about, you know, it'd be like, I don't know. It's almost cannibalistic in a way to me. But bless you. Was that a sneeze?
It was. I'm sorry. I didn't get to my mute button. I had to muffle it.
You had to muffle it. It just broadcast to millions of people worldwide.
it's probably something I caught off the Stucci.
You know, this could be the beginning of a disease. You know, if you sneeze like that, a disease, maybe a worldwide disease, maybe a pandemic. What do you think you'd do if there was a pandemic?
I doubt it. I doubt it very much. But if there was, it wouldn't bother me.
Don't sneeze on your neighbor.
Is that your segue into prepping?
Oh, prepping. Did you still want to talk about prepping tonight? Because I think that's a great topic. Now that you mention it.
I do, actually, because I think the reason why I wanted to talk about prepping this evening and wanted to get a prepper on board the show, really, to get their insights into things, is the current situation on the global scale.
Yes.
You know, we've got the Middle East that's burning away in flames. We've got America that's got this Black Lives Matter campaign going on. And you've got the problems with the police force. You've got the huge military exercise going on down south, which seems to have everybody rattled. You've got Texas that still thinks it wants to be independent. You've got Canada on the up in the north that wants to break down. You've got the guys in the south in Mexico and towards Argentina and so forth who also want to break away. And then we look at Europe, which is in total chaos, and everybody wants to come to Europe from Northern Africa. And then you look at South Africa. And I don't know if you've seen the news over in the States, which I know you don't usually see any news over there at all.
I've got some good friends in South Africa. You know, Gordon is over there, and he talks to me a bit.
Is literally falling apart. There seems to be a tide that is kind of... It's like the going back to the old anti-apartheid days, but it's kind of in a reversal. There seems to be more crime taking place against whites. There seems to be a discrimination against whites. But at the same time, this is stemming from the discrimination that is still inherent against the black communities of South Africa. So South Africa is a nightmare. You've got the problems in Asia, especially with Australia and New Zealand and what they're doing with their migration and immigration policies. You've got the Malaysian problems. There seems to be, as we've discussed many times, this global exodus taking place, this mass migration from one part of the continent to another part of the continent and so forth. We can see all these economic problems taking place, political instability. Take Russia with its incursions into the Ukraine. Again, yesterday, the G7 summit, all of the world leaders with, I might add, Russia, missing from the ranks of the G7. It would then be a G8, really. But, you know, they've all stood up and agreed that the sanctions that were placed upon Russia should stand firm until such time that the Minsk agreement is upheld, again, causing problems within Europe. I had one person who put up a posting the other day, and I thought it was probably one of the most stupid remarks I've ever read with regards to Russia. They said that, well, as long as Obama and the American administration and NATO continue to build up their military presence on the borders of Russia, then Russia has all entitlement to do what it wants to do. And he turned around and said that that NATO should have been disbanded at the same time as the Soviet Union was disbanded. Well, I just, my hands in a ghast. That's such a futile statement. So when it comes to prepping, is prepping a symptom of people, certain people within society, who view these world current events as a way of the overreaction, or are they reacting to them? Are they reacting to the social climate?
Well, I'm finding that there are different kinds of preppers out there. Now, I'm no specialist on prepper. I am not a prepper, although it's in the back of my head as something I should be doing, and hopefully I don't start doing when the conspiracy side of it, before it's too late. But there are preppers, it seems, that are way over on that conspiratorial side of things, which could be anything from, yes, a zombie apocalypse is a real possibility, to the governments are going to fall, to the grid is going to collapse, and you're going to be left with no structure, with anarchy. You're going to have something like Yellowstone Park, the volcano, the big chimera, super volcano beneath Yellowstone Park, explode, and it's going to take out, predicted as it did 200 and some thousand years ago, took out 2/3 of the existing, what is now the existing United States. And if that would happen, what would the people be doing that are left? Would the government still be in place? Or would you have, as Marie D. Jones told me when she wrote a book about this topic, she said she's not so much afraid of what happens when the volcano hits, if you're not in the center of it all. She said she's afraid of what is going to happen to humanity as a result of that. And so so it's very interesting. And that's one side, it seems to me, of the preppers. The other side seems to be, do you have a Liberty Garden in your backyard, as they were calling them a couple of years ago? Are you able to sustain your family if there was a financial crisis or a food crisis? Or if there was a natural disaster or something like that?
So you don't label them as the same. So you make a distinction between.
I think they're both called preppers, but it seems to me that there are different kinds of preppers. There are those who will go all gung ho, and they've got a compound out in the woods somewhere on private land that's buried beneath the ground. It's all prepped for any kind of major catastrophe or major kind of, you know, global thermonuclear war. Or something like that, and they're prepped for that, and they're almost paramilitary in the way they come across, and their supplies are almost like able to supply a paramilitary army for an extended number of months or years after a catastrophe like this. Yet the other side of that seems to be, or the other version of that, seems to be those who want to make sure that you are prepared, say if there's the banks collapse, which is still almost over in that conspiratorial, even though you could say there are a lot of people that are good political, good financial minds that are predicting something like that. That still seems to lay over in that almost conspiratorial realm, because the closest we see to that with a modern country today is a country like Greece. Now, is Greece, do they have a lot of preppers because they're collapsing financially?
No, I mean, look what happened in 2008 with the stock market crash. One could easily see, and look at the aftermath in America. I mean, look at places like Detroit, for instance, as a good example.
Yes.
You see, this is why I wanted to talk about prepping, because for me, prepping, it's about readiness, it's about preparedness, but it's about common sense. It's about not so much going and building a, you know, your vault in the middle of the woods, buried at about 20 to 30 meters beneath ground, and it has enough sustenance to see you out for the rest of your life and so forth. I think it's about common sense. It's about looking at the way in which the world works at the moment, being prepared for that event that may take place in your backyard. Look at the riots that you've had over there of recent months, which have arisen from these killings of these black teenage boys and so forth. If you were to, let's say, for instance, Scotty, let's say, for instance, you would have a riot there in New Richmond, right on your doorstep at the cannery. It was the start of the cannery. They're all being...
Well, it's summertime, so all the Mexican migrant workers from El Paso are up here from Texas.
Let's just say there was a riot in your hometown.
And they, yes.
And it ran amok, and the shops were burning, and the supermarkets were burning. The local utilities were broken, so there's no electricity, there's no gas, there's no telecommunications. The infrastructure that you rely on a day-to-day basis has collapsed. At what point do you bug out? At what point do you dig in? At what point would you go out as a father with a newborn and three other children in the house? At what point would you go out foraging for supplies to see you through for the week? Or would you leave the area in its entirety and go into the town, for instance, go into the city, go into the Twin Cities? At what point, what kicks in? And if that is the case, how do you prepare for that? Do you have these bug out bags? Do you have a room set aside that's shelved out full of water? And
you know, the current nomenclature seems to be that having a bug out bag or a bug out plan is something good to have in place for your family, no matter what extreme or non-extreme you are as a prepper, that you should at least be prepped to feed your family for a week or two. Should something happen of a natural catastrophe, you look at people like, let's go to the ultimate common sense one. You look at things like earthquakes or things like forest fires or things like landslides or these mudslides you're seeing.
Exactly.
This kind of thing, these are natural catastrophes where you may have to take your family, load them up in the car or the truck and with your bug out bags and get out for a while. The question, I think part of prepping could be, do you have enough money in your account to go stay in a hotel with your family for a week if you needed to? That's the practical side of prepping. So all of these little things that we sometimes don't even think about, catastrophic. But what would happen if, like you just said, what if there was a riot? I live in a small town, so burning down the business in my town wouldn't take very long, as you know.
Destroyed all the infrastructure. If you lost all your means,
if all infrastructure in this town, you know, were gone, it would take quite a bit of rioting to prevent anybody from driving to the next city over and buying their groceries. So,
but would you feel safe to?
That's the thing. If there were rioting in the streets, would you want to take your car out? Because no matter where you live in this little town I'm in, unless you're in the outskirts, you're just a few blocks off the main strips. And
that's policed. You could hit a police checkpoint where they are checking cars and you're heading towards it. Guns are pointing at you. You've got the children, you've got Rainy, you've got the wife, you've got the kids, and everything else is in that car. And you all of a sudden you find you've got M16 assault rifles being pointed down on your windshield. What's your reaction going to be? How would you deal with that as a father? These are questions which I don't think these are the questions which I have, basically.
Well, right. And
to know what goes through a prepper's mind and to be labeled as a prepper. I think this is an interesting part.
And keep in mind, this is not a new concept. Think back into the late 40s and into the 50s where it was... you know, there was all-out fear of worldwide nuclear war. And, you know, tuck and cover, duck and cover. That's what it was, duck and cover. We were taught that in the 60s when I was in early grade school. It was duck and cover and get under your desk in case of nuclear war.
And during the 80s, we were scaremongered into the nuclear threat when we had the BBC playing out the film called Freds. I know we've talked about this before, and the day before yesterday, or the day after, or whatever it was called, in America. Came out at the same time with Fonda in it. We were told to take the doors off the hinges of the house and fill black sacks, bin bags, basically, full of dirt and put them around the edges and fill the bath full of water and turn off the gas.
Now, of course, though, you remember you grew up in a country that had been just about 30 years before you were born, had the hell bombed out of it by Nazi Germany. And no, so they probably were already on top of, at least in a certain respect. Do you think 30 years back from today, put it in perspective, back in the 80s, if your country was bombed out by another country, your infrastructure for having some kind of safety protocol in place if you get bombed again is probably still there. And so when you were a kid, and they're telling you sandbags. We never heard sandbags when I was growing up, except when with some of the rivers in North Minnesota flooded or something like that. You'd hear about them sandbagging, you know, building sandbag dikes and things like that. But where you come from in England, I think that there was that infrastructure was in place to say, you know, sandbag this, do that, because your country had recently, in the grand scheme of things, been through that.
Well, I think it's the post-war mentality, and that leads, and that's a good segue actually, Scott, because that leads me to this whole prepping idea. Where in the post-war mentality, during the 50s and the 60s and 70s, do we see prepping? What part is it? Do we only see it if we look deep enough within society and see that the nuclear threat from Russia and Cuba, for instance, in your case, was that enough to start the cannery business? You know, did we all go around canning did the word prepping actually exist in the vocabulary? I doubt it did.
It wasn't in the vernacular like it is today, because face it, when you define what prepping means today, it probably meant a very different thing 40, 50 years ago. Because prepping today invokes these images of, you know, the nuclear symbol, gas masks, getting your survival knives all sharpened up, and having your ammo in an ammo locker, and having, you know, enough jugs of fresh water to last 3 months or something stashed in your garage.
If you were to go, say, 30 years to the 1980s.
Yes.
If I say the name David Kadesh to you.
Oh, yes.
Now, Waco, Texas, was he prepping?
I think he was definitely isolationist. He was pulling his people out. Now, there's been a lot of examination of what he was, and they say that this was a very unjust action that took place there.
As we all know.
Yeah, but what were they doing? They were, in a sense, separating themselves out from the rest of society and running their own microcosm, their own microcosm of society, their own mini. What's the word I'm talking? Is it like a subculture, this is what they were doing?
Their own community that was self-sustainable outside of the main infrastructure of the community, the larger community in which they lived.
This reminds me, you know, let me say this now before we have to go out to break, and then let's pick up your thoughts. But I was talking to, of all people, Shirley MacLaine. Had interviewed me on her radio show back when the Nephilim book came out 3 years ago. And we were talking on her show, and she said something about, we got into, of course, as you can imagine, talking with Shirley MacLaine, getting into all this philosophical stuff. And she was talking about, well, don't you think, Scotty, that we could all just go to an island somewhere and create our own society that is free of all this heartache and free of all the, you know, she's going into all of that. And I said, frankly, no. I said, I think that's, and I said, all due respect, that's kind of a BS thought. I said, because you're not changing anything by segregating yourselves from society, because you bring it with you. It's inside. It's people that do these things. Not those people. It's people. And I said, you're going to run into those same problems. And I think some of this is reflected in some of the fictional television shows you see in the books and the movies and things about these groups that are left
after. That's where I want to get to after the break.
Let's get to that. Let's get to the like a post-apocalyptic, post-catastrophic society where you've got these groups of people and see what goes on as that happens. So, folks, you're listening to the Intrepid Radio program right here on the IPBN Talk Radio Network, Alternative Talk Radio Network. This is Scotty Roberts, Dr. John Ward.
We're going to be over here in the corner talking very slowly in BBC.
That would be John way. Over in the BBC.
Lord
asking
John
you to have you. A delightful evening as you listen to our dulcet tones on the news and current events.
Yes.
We'll be back. Sit tight.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
Thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle. Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you, year after year, with the very best thinkers in their fields. From ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best f***ing awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to ScottAllenRoberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
I listen to Intrepid. with Dr. John Ward and Scotty, transmitting across all nations. Talk radio with pure intelligence. Broadcasting to you live each Sunday from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern on Intrepid Paradigm Radio. Hapu, bless you, John and Scotty.
You are listening to the Intrepid Paradigm Radio Network in association with EBN, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Hudson, Wisconsin.
Live in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
And yes, that's intelligent talk with intelligent breaks. How about that? John, how you doing over there in Sweden? Welcome back to the second hour.
I'm doing really well. Thank you, brother.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, it's great to hear your voice. You know, this whole prepping thing is, it's an interesting thing because while I am not a prepper, I'm somebody who has thought that I ought to be prepping, but that's because I see, well, first of all, you see the pop cultural side. You see all the shows that are out there showing it, and all those people look pretty wacky to me. And apologies to anybody who's a prepper who goes, hey, that's just how we do it. Apologies to you, because sometimes these, production house produced, television series that are reality series of doomsday preppers and things like that just look a little offhanded to me and, just a little odd.
I will admit though, that I, to a certain extent, did a little bit of prepping when I was in Egypt, and I'm glad I did.
Well, sure.
So.
I'm sure you had your bug out bag for Egypt.
We do.
Never know who's going to come walking over the hill.
But we kept ample supplies of food and water and other fuels and other essentials in the house. We kept a full emergency first aid kit, right down to tranquilizers and so forth. And I'm glad we kept all of that, because when the revolution happened, we weren't affected. Now, you've seen my larder, if you remember my larder in the kitchen.
Yes, yes. I
purposely purchased all those large, great big glass, what we call jerkins over there, which held all the dried food. And I kept it well stocked all the year round, just in case. And I'm glad, because when the revolution happened, we were fully prepared. We had everything.
And I know just even recently in the last year in Luxor, Egypt, where you live, there was, as tourists stopped coming and as money stopped flowing in, and it was becoming a bit of a ghost town there. And you said it was sometimes going to get groceries was quite a task at times.
It was. And so there is a serious side to prepping. And I think that today's society, and just harking back to what you said just before the break, and you just touched upon it now, I think that, again, social media, television perceptions, especially with documentaries and, of course, entertainment shows like The Walking Dead, et cetera, these post-apocalyptic shows, do actually have a kind of effect upon the psyche of the communities, the social community. where people will start to think about, well, what would happen in case of. We've seen natural disasters. Again, we go back to the way in which our technological age allows us to know exactly what's happening anywhere on the globe within minutes of it happening. As most of the audience know, I am, and I'm sure the audiences, members of the audience have this as well. I have the email alerts for all of the earthquakes.
Yes. You know what's interesting about that? If I can interject something here, with all the talk of ISIS and so on, and by the way, on the line, let me forget my point, but and that's my local train coming by. On the line, I have Nancy Planetta, Wiccan Vixen, over in the chat room. Nancy, I want to welcome you back to Intrepid Radio.
Hello, my love.
How you doing?
I'm good.
You
hey,
are.
John.
Good morning, Nancy. How are you, my darling?
I'm good, my darling.
You are somebody that I see can speak to almost any topic cogently. If it's a topic in anything from politics to, I think, probably preppers, even though you and I haven't really talked about that. When I saw you in the chat room tonight, I said, I'll bet Nancy could talk to this topic pretty well. But what I was thinking was, and the reason I called you in when I did, because I was going to reference you, we had a show maybe a year ago where we were talking about ISIS, and you joined John and me, and we had L.A. Marzulli in for part of the show, but we were talking about how close to biblical-type prophecies of Armageddon do you see the things that are happening in the Middle East, and that was the topic of our show. And, John, you just cued in on something that we used to talk about when I was in junior high school and high school. This is back before we had cell phones. I mean, we still had a lot of black and white TV. We were talking the 70s. People around us had color. We were poor. We had a black and white TV. But with the technology, it was not then what it is now. And we used to talk about eschatology and end times things and looking at the Middle East even back then in the 70s. And saying, you know, the biblical prophecies said that the whole world would see when the two witnesses were beheaded in the street, or when, and the beheading was there, and that's taken on a whole new tone, that all the events of the end times of the Antichrist and the government and the politics and all this, that everybody in the world would see it simultaneously. And you thought, how are they going to be able to do that? And even back in the 70s, they said, well, you know, all know how we can do it now because you can catch it on the news and you can call somebody on the telephone. But now look at technology and tie that into all of this prepping stuff is that, yes, we have the ability to communicate instantaneously. But what happens, first of all, we're going to know about catastrophes around the world, John, like you were saying. These things are going to hit. Our cell phones are going to hit our laptops, our devices, our televisions almost instantaneously. But what happens if the catastrophe is the grid is gone, the grid goes down, there is none of that ability to communicate? What is going to happen then? Or is that, and Nancy, let me get your input, John, yours too, is that something that's just folly? It just could never happen.
It could never, you've got to be kidding me. Our infrastructure is falling apart in this country. Could it never happen? Yeah, no. Of course it can happen. I mean, we just saw news reports in the past 2 months that the United States, the U.S. Navy was saying that they had actually brought online and had an EMP weapon that could, you know, debilitate North Korea's infrastructure, China's infrastructure. So we went public here with having that weapon. Now, if we went public with that, that means we've had that weapon for at least 20 years. And they probably have that weapon, too.
Yeah.
I mean, is it impossible to actually know? A solar flare can completely debilitate our grid. I mean, people don't understand that. We've been threading a needle when it comes to different CMEs, and which is a coronal mass ejection. You know, we really take a chance every time we face the barrel of the sun.
What I was going to say was, look at us in Egypt. During the first 2 weeks of the revolution of 2011, we lost all telecommunications. We had no mobiles that were working. The telephone system was offline. There was no internet. There was no radio. The only thing, and then all the certain channels started going offline. So our satellites were going down. I thankfully had a satellite phone. I was able to get a message to my family. My brother then put a word out on Facebook to say to all my friends out there that we're safe, we're sound, we're okay. We're still in Luxor and we're riding it out. But we lost all infrastructure, and that literally happened in a process of just 2 weeks from the fall of Mubarak when he decided to step down. During that two-week period, it was complete and total chaos. We saw looting on mass scale looting. Nothing like you've seen in Ferguson. I mean, that was a joy in the picnic.
Now, and thievery is supposed to be against Islamic law, Sharia law. So I've heard many Muslims say we don't steal because it's against Sharia.
You're looking at what I was asking you before, Scotty. As a father, as a husband, at what point do you leave the safety and the security of your house to go in search and forage supplies?
Or you become Jean Valjean from Tale of Two Cities. You become the man who steals a loaf of bread to feed his family.
Yes, but when do you take advantage of the situation
right.
to exploit the situation and think, well, I know this isn't going to last. But does that?
But isn't this what prepping is all about? It's prepping so that you don't have to take that kind of unethical step at that time because you're ready for it.
Exactly.
Yes and no. It depends on where you live, Scotty. Again, I mentioned it in the chat, and I'll say it again. When we live in a country that's passing laws that make, in the event of martial law being declared nationwide, they make it basically legal on paper that they can enter your homes and take whatever supplies you have. It's why I don't understand why they have shows like Doomsday Preppers and as such, because if you're a true prepper, you don't want anybody knowing that you're prepping.
That's right. You don't want people knowing.
If something happens, they're going to come in. They have the ability by law to come in and take whatever they need to sustain them. That's what I say, that when I see things like that, when I see governments making moves like that, it is very bothersome to me. When I see, even lately, you and I spoke the other day about the erratic earthquakes that are going on. And when I see a government run, NOAA, when I see quakes appearing on the NOAA site and then disappearing as fast as they appeared, and then, we made a mistake, not once, but three times in one weekend.
That was very interesting. What was your take on that, Nancy? Because I saw that, and a lot of my friends out there saw that, and they made notes of it publicly. I didn't go out with it publicly because I thought there was obviously a reason why it's being taken down, and then we made a mistake. But it happened three times on the trot, and as you know, Nancy, both of us, we've been looking at NOAA now for years. There's a lot of people out there who have only been looking at it over the past couple of years, say, but I've been there since its very beginning. Why do you think they actually took those earthquake readings down?
Honestly, my gut feeling, and this, I'm a person who watches, I mean, Scotty will tell you that, I watch the solar side, I watch everything. I mean, I really do, because I do not like the way things are, I don't like the way I feel right now. And I tell people that all the time, call it a gut instinct, call it what you want. I don't really care. I am not comfortable with the frequencies right now. Something's not right. And I think, honestly, something's going on with the crustal movement. I think they're aware of it. I think they are basically stockpiling against it at this point, but I don't know if it can be controlled. I do find it immeasurably interesting that we can correlate a lot of this to CERN's activity, which
I was going to say, what point are you going to bring in CERN here? Because with CERN being ranked up, I mean, she's operating now, I believe, at 75 to 80% of her capacity.
And the highest power she's ever operated at.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that the solar activity, we've gone through a cycle this past month and so, where we've seen increased solar activity. We've seen a lot of K indexes up there. And usually that always, always precedes earthquake activity, seismic events. So we've seen an increase in solar activity around the K indexes. We've seen increased earthquake activity, but we've also seen the pumping up of CERN and working up to about 80% of her capacity. Do you think that we can tie any of this in? And I don't want to go down the energetic side.
The rabbit hole, right?
I want to ask you about that, about the energetic values of solar activity against the negative emotions of people itself and how that affects us.
So you're talking this whole Jungian collective unconsciousness that we were talking about on the Situation Room a couple of weeks ago, right?
If you've ever looked at the readouts from CERN, when CERN is active, when they flip the collider on, and you know it powers up, and people—I don't think people understand how much they say. Oh, it's safe. The scientists say it's safe. It's contained. Well, yeah, no, you're still shocking the crap. I mean, in a type of energy measurement that most of us aren't even familiar with, out of the core of the planet, every time this thing is powered up, it also emits microwave energy, which doesn't go away. That's not contained. That is, you can actually look at graphs that show the actual flow of the frequencies around the planet when CERN is active, and they are really put off. It's a very unusual flow of energy, and I can't, you know, this planet is a very delicate balance to maintain life, and I don't think people quite get that. And you guys both know me. I am not a global warming freak. I am not, I really am not. But I think we're playing with things we should not be playing with when it comes to CERN. But I can't figure out if they're using CERN to try to slow down a process that's already happening or if it's accelerating the process. That's kind of where I get caught up. I can definitely see a link.
You've just given me a segue there, Nancy, because I mentioned at the end of last week's show that when we wanted to talk about prepping, I wanted to bring up, and I don't want to go into it in depth, but the Georgia Guidestones and the reduced the population. Where do you stand on that? And do you as a conspiracy theory, or do you regard them as something that is should be taken a little bit more seriously?
John, I put nothing past the powers that be. And maybe you can call me a complete narcissist when it comes to people who hold great power. I think they want nothing more than to cull the population. I think, you know, people who have tremendous amount of money, Bill Gates, George Soros, have made it very clear in both speech and in action that they feel the world is overpopulated. I do not think they would have a problem calling us because we're dispensable. I mean, we are expendable, literally. We're like cockroaches right now on the planet. We literally are. My problem with the Guidestones is that we can't put our finger on exactly who would do it and why. And why, if that was the plan, would they have left them erect? Is it their pride? Are they in your facing it to us, or are they leaving it erect because they just don't care? I can't, that's what bothers me with the Guidestones. However, that being said, you know, Scotty brought up ISIS earlier, and Scotty knows, and you know, we've had this conversation, that I truly feel ISIS was the birth child of the United States for a reason, because I think they wanted Assad out of power. And I think, you know, we did what we had to do, and we burgeoned the beast, and here we go. Now they're romping all over the place, and we're not really doing a lot to stop them. And that's, again, very bothersome. But why? You know, we're seeing all these Armageddon predictions and all these predictions, end world, end times. Here's the Antichrist. Look, this matches biblical text. Well, guess what? The Bible's been around for well over 2,000 years. And yes, world leaders are probably just as adept at reading it as the rest of us are. Heck, I'm a pagan and I still have read the Bible. I know what it says. And I'm thinking, are these events coming to pass because it's their time? Are they coming to pass because the powers that be want us to believe it's our time? So if they pull a plug, or if they decide to make an action or do something that throws us into World War III, they can say, oh, it was biblically prophesied.
Well, I also wonder if this is where the collective consciousness is being not just tapped into, but the converse being created a bit. And because they understand that there is a power in collective So, well, Jung called it unconsciousness. It's collective unconsciousness as opposed to collective consciousness. And I think that I wonder if there is a bit of that tapping into that to help create that. And that there is a reason that somebody who, and as John has written about the hidden hand, and we're talking more and more about this these days on these shows, when John has written about the hidden hand and all the things that are at play, and why would we have created ISIS, and why would ISIS have gone off in the direction it's gone off in? I'm pretty sure they didn't create ISIS to do what it's doing now. So why did they do what they did? To me, it doesn't matter who created something. It all has to do with the people who, unless they're clones of some sort or brainwashed in some way, those people are still responsible for their own actions. The people
in
power.
But the government are masters of creating and destabilizing a situation. They know exactly what they're doing. Our government's had over 200 years of experience doing it.
I must admit, Nancy, I do have problems with the notion. I'll put it that way, politely, the notion that the United States government were the creators of ISIS. I think they had a hand in it, but that was a political hand in the instability or the lack of instability within the Middle East in general. I think they with their actions in Iraq and their actions in Syria, Iran, Afghanistan, etc., it's the same as the coalition, because the finger cannot solely point at America. There is a coalition force in play. The power void that they left, as well as the rise of the Arab Spring, was the catalysts for ISIS. I don't think we can place the blame squarely on the carpet of the White House for ISIS. ISIS
is the microphone. But I have a hard time because I'm aware of the military equipment that we left behind.
Well,
was rigged.
Having lived there, Nancy, and being amongst, shall we say, these various factions of Islam, I'm more than aware of how this has taken place. But from my own personal point of view, I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just giving you a point of view from someone who's been there on the ground, and I think this really the catalysts were there, which we instigated as a coalition. But I think it is basically ISIS is a microcosm, a complete microcosm of the instability of the Middle East in general.
Absolutely.
Renaissance of Islam. And Islam itself is trying to emerge or trying to enter a Renaissance period. And ISIS is merely a product of that. And you can see that on a worldwide scale, because it's not confined to just Syria and Iraq. ISIS is prevalent in most, near enough now, every country in the world. And that is a problem that we need to tackle head on. But again, talking about the prepping and so forth, is this what we're doing? Are we, and I like what you're saying there, Scotty, because I think this is where I wanted to get to. Are we actually prepping on a collective subconscious?
That is a fantastic question. You know what? We're going to tackle that after the break. And Nancy, if you can stick around with us, I want to get your input on this as well. And we should have had you in on since the beginning of this conversation, so I'm glad you're here. But, folks, you're listening to the Intrepid Radio Program right here on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. And John Ward and me, Scotty Roberts, and our guest, kind of a ad hoc guest. Is that be a good way to put you?
That'll work.
A listener guest. Good friend of our show, Nancy Planetta. And we'll be back talking about this whole prepper thing and this whole collective unconsciousness thing. Think Jung. Go ahead and go look that up during the break, and join us in the conversation after this. Sit tight and stand by.
Hello, my name is Patrick Sullivan. I'm a boxer and a Guinness drinker. Now, it's come to my attention that you lads in America only drink Guinness on special occasions. So let me tell you about that special occasion that finds me drinking a pint of Guinness. I was fighting Michael the Hammer Halleck when the referee stopped the fight in the fourth round due to excessive bleeding. As the referee led poor Hammer, covered in blood, to his corner, all I could think about was I was going to win for the first time in 57 professional fights. However, the referee soon made the discovery that it was my blood covering old Hammer. And what can I say? I'm a bleeder by nature. Now, you might be thinking, oh, in 57's not much of a special occasion. And that's my point exactly. You can drink Guinness any day. Sure, it's dark, but a drink smooth and easy. You may even find it refreshes your spirit. So don't be so precious with your pints. Grab a Guinness, because it's good to drink.
Guinness Stout, imported by Guinness Fast Import Company, Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, and if you think the Irish only bleed Kelly Green, just come to one of my fights.
When we make Beyond Natural dry dog and cat foods, we start with real meat as the first ingredient. We leave out corn, wheat, and soy. And we own where our dry food is made. 100%. Can other brands say all that? For nutrition you can trust and your pet will enjoy. Does your food go beyond? Learn more at PurinaBeyond.com.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best f***ing awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to ScottAllenRoberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com, to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be Bridging the Gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you, year after year, with the very best thinkers in their fields. From ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
Our folks, we're back home right here on the mics at the Intrepid Radio program. John Ward over there in Sweden joining us for this last segment, and our good friend Nancy Planetta. And there's so much that starts to get wrapped up in this talk of prepping. You see that that's where we started, and you see where we're starting to go with the collective consciousness. But before we do, Nancy, you reminded me of a story during the break here. And it's a story that I saw. And, John, I wanted to get your input on this, and Nancy, your input on this, too. You remember, you all heard about John Kerry's bicycling accident.
Yeah,
during all the talks over there. Well, there's this, I'm going to read one source. There's 100 sources for this story all over the internet. And John, have you heard about the conspiracy theory that this is actually an assassination attempt was made on him?
Yes.
And there's this wacky rumor about John Kerry's biking accident. Some Iranian news outlets are claiming that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, was injured this weekend, not in Switzerland in a bike crash, but rather in an assassination attempt during a secret meeting with Islamic State group representatives. And the Jerusalem Post reported Wednesday that the Iranian news agency Nasim posted a report on the claim that the alleged secret meeting on Sunday culminated in an armed clash and an attempt to kill the top U.S. diplomat. And now, I wouldn't say that would be so far-fetched for ISIS representatives. But the conspiracy theory was cloaked in this aura of international intrigue, with plot twists connecting Switzerland, France, Russia, and a U.S.-trained Islamic State loyalist from Tajikistan. I can never say that. You know where I'm talking about. Tajikistan. Which the Jerusalem Post described as follows. They said, quote, Kerry's meeting in which the alleged assassination attempt took place was with the Gulmurad Kalimov, a senior Tajik police commander trained in the United States who announced his defection to Islamic State in a video released last week. The Iranian news site report states.
This is the guy that I was talking to you about.
Yes.
The conspiracy theory that's out there about Kerry being the attempted assassination holds a lot of water. Holds a lot of water.
I agree.
It does.
And Nancy, I'd like your take on this. And I don't want to go again.
I don't want to go too far afield here before we get back into topic. But
it's still on topic. What is your take on the recent, and when I say recent, I'm going to take on the last, since 2008, which is quite a significant year, as we all know. What's your take on the significance that Switzerland has become more and more prevalent within the news as a place where the news actually emanates from?
Well, again, what else is in Switzerland, John? I know you know the answer. I mean, the thing is that people kind of underestimate Switzerland, and they always have underestimated Switzerland throughout several world wars. Switzerland likes to play neutral, and they are, you know, they became the banking hub, and they became the safe zone, and made themselves very, 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 very wealthy in the interim doing that. A lot of the largest pharmacies in the world run out of Switzerland, and people don't realize that. Let me tell you something. The pharmaceutical industry is nothing to joke about, and I've always told people, sometimes I wonder if wars aren't started just to make the pharmaceutical industry more money, because they profit exponentially from war.
You remember the movie, the Harrison Ford movie, The Fugitive. They built that whole plot premise around that conspiracy that the pharmaceutical companies are the ones that are out there committing really grossly heinous crimes in order to establish themselves. So,
but not going too far off that, John, I agree with you. There are reasons everything is centered around Switzerland. again, that's it seems to be a hub of many things right now, between politics and science and world events. Yeah, Switzerland seems to be a real hot spot, and I think that's intentionally.
Most definitely.
I mean, it's something to me that's not it's not a high go seek thing. It's if you're paying attention to world events, you're definitely seeing the similarities and the correlations. And again, with Kerry, let me tell you something. When I first heard that report, it didn't make any sense to me. Number one, because he's a world figure, and we got zero photographs, nothing, and still to this day have had no photographs except a stretcher being wheeled out of a large aircraft.
Have we even seen him live on TV since that?
No, there's been no vocal connection. In other words, the only thing that we've seen is a tweet on his State Department Twitter account, but that could have been any one of his administration.
Oh, sure.
I'm sure they have access.
Unless it was on his private server.
Not only that, they're saying in Boston that, yeah, right, they're saying in Boston that his jet was not, it not only came in, but it was accompanied by three F-16 fighters who people with military experience were saying were flying in a defense formation around the plane, which kind of makes you shake your head. And that when the president called for updates, they were told no comment.
Yeah.
And not only that, how many of you guys have heard of a broken femur putting somebody in the hospital since, oh, I don't know, May 31st?
Exactly. I want to get back, if we can, because I know we're limited on time in the last half hour here of the show. The prepping side, how far, Nancy, Scotty, how far do you think it can really go on? And I want to touch upon the realms of the collective unconsciousness, but when we see the mass exodus and the migration that's taking place on a global scale from refugees, migrants, immigrants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, how many of them do you think we can term as preppers, but preppers on the move?
I think they've been actually conditioned to be preppers on the move. That's survival job. And I think that's kind of what we may be getting from the collective consciousness right now, a need to survive. And any feeling, that's what it is.
And a survivalist generally isn't somebody that's going to camp out in a basement somewhere. A survivalist is somebody who can live in the woods, who can live in the wild, who can be very portable and very light about it.
I think that terminology has changed, Scotty.
But is a survivalist different than a prepper?
No, I think those two go hand in hand now. I think we're seeing certain attitudes within our society, which is changing the terminology. Take some of the migrants, especially in the island of Kos, which I recently posted and described, there was a nice discussion going on that, where they're receiving upwards of 4,000 migrants per day, on the island of Kos. Now, the island of Kos, before the migration or the modern day exodus started taking place back in 2013, which is relatively recent, the population of Kos was at 30,000 for the indigenous population. They've now had an influx of 4,000 people per day flooding the area. And the people are surviving. They are surviving in disused hotels, disused warehouses, in the urban field. They are eking an existence in the urban field. Even here in Halmstad, where I'm staying in Sweden at this present moment, there is local reports in the news of the local immigrants that have come over from from Northern Africa, worked their way up from Italy, all the way up here into the Scandinavian countries. They are in the survival mode. They are survivalists, and they've actually started to cull and dwindle the headcount of the local moose and local deer count, that the numbers there have dwindled so much because they're being hunted and killed for food to survive. So that is putting it into a different perspective. We're seeing, as you quite rightly said before, Nancy, there's a delicate harmony on this planet. And when we see certain, we can take ants, for instance, or take in human behavior, if we place something in an alien position, the strongest will take over. But the survival instinct is one of the most reckless, destructive forces that we have in us. And at the moment, we're seeing it on a global scale. And yet no one is really discussing it. They're not discussing the implications. They're discussing the charitable side. The IMF yesterday came out and said they're going to donate over $800 million to the plight of the Iraqi people. But they're not discussing the Iraqi people that have left Iraq. They're not discussing the implications of the cultural diversity. Are we looking at a complete, go back now, a complete collective unconsciousness of prepping? I think we are. Yeah. I think we're living through a very difficult time.
You know, Lynn brings up something very important I want to talk about before we get off the topic at the end of the show. She mentioned the biggest common trait I can think of is both communities, survivalist and prepper, are prone to being isolationist. And I think that this is one of the problems that I saw with when I was doing some reading up on this topic, is that the whole prepping idea of building a community so you can stay safe and isolate yourselves in the world is not what will make the world survive. It might make your group survive for a little while, but it is one of the negative points, really, to having a community, a small community like this that you put together for the purpose of surviving a major catastrophe or a major event, because the rebuilding of society is what will save us all after that point. Otherwise, you have, in essence, and not to over-romanticize it, but you have, in a sense, almost roving bands or isolated little tribes that are, you've got a Lord of the Flies in post-apocalyptic settings, so to speak. You've got
but I think that's going to happen either way, Scotty. I think we're seeing that right now.
It's going to be chaos. We're witnessing that now. We're witnessing the development of the tribes taking place within modern Europe. We're seeing that. I've discussed this at length, and no one's picking up on this. When we talk about the cultural diversity of the migrant problem within Europe, that in itself is a tribal action. We are seeing the development of tribes on the streets. We're seeing the development of tribes in the suburbs, in the ghettos, in businesses, where they have come over and they're injecting money into local businesses, and they are creating tribes. And you've got that problem as well in America. It's a global problem. Again, it's isolationism. It's segregation. In some instances, I use the word apartheid. It's racist. It's something that people really, we've got to really start tackling these problems before they get completely out of hand.
What I always like to tell people is in times of, we have two different reactions in times of great adversity. We either have the coming together or we have the falling apart. It always goes one of two ways. It's never in the middle, if you've ever noticed that. I mean, if we look at catastrophes around the world, it either made a nation or destroyed the nation. Even, you know, recently we have in the United States, we've had the riots in Baltimore, we've had the riots in Ferguson, and we want to blame that on racism. And it is, in some ways, racism is part of the problem, but it's also part of the problem because we kind of created our own situation here.
Well, you could,
you know, we allowed for a situation to develop. We allowed the ghettos to develop. We allowed the segregation, even though we demanded desegregation. We actually segregated them more.
But see, I think we isolate us against them. Other, we developed that is what we're saying. We developed. We allowed that to happen. You're saying we collectively, or the opposite of the people that are there that are being blamed for all the discontent that are within those ghettos or within those walls.
I think Americans became very content with the 1980s. I think we lived large in the 1980s.
We did.
I think we became used to having what we wanted in the 1980s, and we didn't think about the people who weren't getting what they wanted because, hey, they had government supplements. They had food stamps. They didn't have to worry. They could eat. They had lights on in their house.
But you know what?
We took care of that because we made a lot of money.
You know what's interesting is this could also really very easily shift into that negative side of what we're talking about with prepping. Should the doo-doo hit the fan, so to speak. It's that this prepper, the prepper culture has grown very prominent. And in that, and one of the main philosophies, it's almost the underlying everything is this, let's call it the I'll defend what's mine phenomenon. It's this defend what's mine mentality. It kind of states that The moment this all goes down, every other human in the world instantly becomes either a resource to be used or a threat to be eliminated.
And they become a suspect.
Whomever, this is what I was talking about, as tribal, this Lord of the Flies feel, whomever you designate as your tribe are the only people with any value, because all others are simply the mindless sheep to be picked off with your shiny new AR-15 and or to be brought into the fold if you deem them useful as a resource to you. And this is what I think you're going to find happening if we were ever thrust on a global scale or a national scale into this type of a scenario. And I think sometimes the prepping, when taken to that degree, can lead to that. That's really the basis for that tribal mentality. Rainey and I were sitting here on the front of the house a while back, and we were looking out talking about, you know, this kind of stuff. We naturally like The Walking Dead. And so it was probably a couple of seasons ago when we're watching The Walking Dead. And this is the kind of scenario that's really being played out in there, is the unaffected people are turned into these tribes. And we were sitting out on the front step just looking at our neighborhood and saying, now if some catastrophe came down, oh, I know what it was. It was during we had a little brownout here in our little town, and everything just went dark for about an hour, and the power grid was down. And we're sitting there thinking, how long do you think the power would have to be out before, oh, Brandon, nine houses down the side street there with his AK-47 comes out hunting for food and looking for the houses that have it? Or how long before you think the neighborhood starts splitting off and you start having this kind of activity going on? So prepping as individuals or an individual family, I think, is necessary to a certain degree when you don't go into that wild side of it. But what happens if that wild side takes place?
I think they're going to be the only ones left.
I mean, I live in a state, Scotty, where, you know, I live in Florida, where we have, you know, we have hurricanes, and we've had our definite fair share of situations where we were down with power. And I mean, back in 2004, I knew you back then, and you know, we got hit with the quad storms, and I had a tree in the middle of my house, and I didn't have power for 2 weeks.
I remember that.
You know, thank God I am, you know, I've always been somewhat of a prepper out of nature, because I live in a state where that's a distinct possibility. You're going to lose power. You're not going to have running water. It just depends. But I can tell you that there was a tremendous, especially with Charlie, there was a tremendous amount of looting and a tremendous amount of damage that never made it to national news, mainly because Charlie smacked into Orlando, and it was between a Category 3 and a Category 2, and it did a tremendous amount of damage to Orlando. And Disney did not want that getting out, because it would have affected their sales.
No doubt, yeah.
But, I mean, I can tell you for a fact, because my mom was an insurance adjuster, and they were sending body bags to Orlando because they didn't have enough. And yet, I think they only publicly stated there was like 15 or 16 deaths. It was way above that. You know, the corporations definitely had an impact on how things were reported, and the violence that took place within that city, because there was no power. There were no emergency response vehicles. I mean, once the winds go up above 40, 50 miles an hour, they do not deploy emergency response. They can't, because it becomes a safety factor to the emergency response people. You're in a high-profile fire truck, 40, 50 mile an hour winds, you're taking a huge risk.
I'm sure you are.
Especially with down power lines. I mean, I can tell you that people look after their family first. You guys say tribe, I say family. When it comes to, you have one bottle of water and somebody saying, give me that bottle of water, and you've got four people that are going to try to survive off that bottle of water, am I going to shoot that person if they make a move towards that bottle of water? Yeah, most likely I would.
Sure, sure.
I mean, because they're not wanting to share.
It's the survival instinct in us all. The tribe becomes part and parcel, but the survival instinct on an individual basis. And again, I draw back heavily upon the father scenario. What the father, what lengths he will go to protect his family and provide them with the sustenance that they require to survive a whatever event. And I think we're seeing that being played out right now. And I think it's very sad.
100% agree.
It's very, very sad that the general populace doesn't recognize it.
You know, I do wonder, though, John, when we talk about the unconscious and the global unconscious and even the universal unconscious, because I don't believe it's just global. You know, you have to wonder if, again, when we were talking about CERN and I was telling you that it puts out microwaves, it does affect our magnetic field. That's a proven fact.
Yes.
You know, we all have magnetite in our pineal gland, It's a proven fact. Again, we are migratory by nature.
Yes.
As we've grown and as we have become what we are, those instincts have somewhat become dormant, but they're never gone. Did you ever think that maybe if we're affecting the magnetic field, I mean, just not even 2 years ago, the Inuits were screaming at the top of their lungs because they were saying, hey, something's wrong with the rotation of the planet because our sun is not coming up in the same place anymore and it's not setting in the same place anymore and it's completely screwing up our hunting.
Yeah, I mean, no one paid attention.
Nobody was paying attention. They were like, you know, since 2009, since that earthquake in Chile, there's been a distinctive difference in where our sun's rising and where it's setting, and it's affecting migratory patterns of the animals. It's affecting our ability to hunt those animals.
Well, keep in mind, Nancy, you and I were talking about this back in when it was all big in the news several years ago now, 5, 6, 7 years ago, when they were when you were seeing all the flocks
of birds
just dying in mid-flight, whole flocks dropping to the ground, or schools of fish washing up in lakes and in oceans and things like that. And, of course, all of these animals, they're migratory by nature. They have that magnetite. In a sense, it's almost like the easiest way to describe it, like a little chip of metal in their brain, that magnetite that gives them the ability to be migratory. And you were seeing them just dying off. All of a sudden, boom, they were gone. And you see these flocks and schools and all of this washing up. And one of the theories was, you know, it had to do with the Earth's magnetic field being either messed with or starting to devolve in certain areas and things like that. So,
well, we know it's, right now it's in a cycle where it's devolved by 10%, but it is a natural cyclical means of it moving, but we are also in a very, very powerful solar cycle that was supposed to have diminished, and it hasn't.
Right.
Yes.
And when you have the likes of Michio Kaku, who I respect, I mean, I know a lot of people say, oh, he's too far down the rabbit hole, but the man is incredibly intelligent and an extremely, extremely well-respected physicist. When he's saying, guys, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
You need to kind of pay attention. And you've heard me for years, Scotty. You've heard me for years. How many years have I been saying something's wrong with the magnetics, dude?
Yes.
Something's wrong with the frequencies. I can tell you right now something is off. I can feel it. Something's off.
Well, you know what? You probably can't hear the music on your end, but we've got less than a minute of the show left. We've run it right up to the end. So I want to thank Nancy. Thanks for being here. We did not delve the depths of this topic. We're going to have to do it some more later. Thanks for joining us for this last hour. I think you've been with us, so thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
Folks, you've been listening to the Intrepid Radio program right here on the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. We'll be back on Thursday with Rocky Stucci, John Ward, and myself for the Situation Room, where we try to get a little deeper and heavier than this conversation went tonight, the lighthearted conversation we had tonight. And that'll be at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time on Thursday, right here on the IPBN-FM.com. John and I will be here next week at same bat time, same bat channel. We're out of here. John, say goodnight.
Good night.
Desolation comes upon the sky. Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire.